All right, well, good evening, everybody. I'm thankful to be here with you this evening, thankful for your attendance here. It's good to see you in person. I'm still getting used to distance learning here, where I'm up here, not down there with you all. But believe me, I'd much rather be on the floor just for Bible class. I'd much rather be around a table, but this would be an awfully big table. Maybe we can work on that. We're in this evening the very end of the book of Leviticus. This is sort of a bit strange, I know, to a lot of those of us who grew up, you know, reading the Bible in order and reading the books in order. And I think, and I would be the first proponent to say that, you know, it was written in the order that it was meant to be read. But we're approaching this from a little bit of a different angle. We're coming at the book of Leviticus thematically, looking at the major themes. The book is organized on a sort of a symmetrical system of themes. And the opening and closing chapters of the book deal, kind of to paint with a broad brush, they deal with the concept of worship. And by that I don't mean they deal with the times when Israel came together only. Now there's a lot of that found there. In the opening chapters, 1 through 7, there is devoted to the offerings, both instructions to all Israel, as well as specific instructions to the priest, how to help them with their offerings. Here at the end of the book, we find the corresponding section to the front of the book dealing with worship, but we're not dealing with sacrifice. Israelite worship was not all about sacrifice, just like our worship is not all about Sunday morning. It's not all about singing. It's not all about prayer. There are several elements that are mixed in, and it was the same with Israelite worship. What we want to notice tonight is that Israelite worship wasn't just what they offered and what feasts they went to. It was a part of their lives. It was their life. They lived, in a lot of ways, worshiping God. And I want that to be clear. I want that to be brought out as we have time to discuss it this evening. I'm going to let you guys start with the opening question. What's this section of Leviticus about? And you can essentially say any religious word and probably get it right in this section. But if you don't want to give a summary to all of it, we've sort of done that already, the idea of worship, but what did you find in this section? What did you notice as you read through the closing chapters of the book? Oh, certainly. So that's a big theme. And it's definitely a theme in the first seven, and it's definitely a theme in the last, you know, four, five, six chapters of the book. God wants us to be serious, definitely. Right, right. And based on very strict valuations of either people or animals or houses or things like that, definitely. God takes it very seriously. Good. What else did you see? What did you see when you read through? Back to the theme of the way God instructed them to give or to offer or to worship. That's the way they needed to be doing. And that would definitely fit into what do we do with the passage, right? What does it teach us, right? But I want to start this evening with what's there, right? You open it to Leviticus 23 or one of those later chapters. What do you find written there? What's it about? Absolutely. Chapter 23 really is the chapter dealing with feasts, okay, and what time of year they were to be offering these feasts, what was the purpose for them, how long would they last, all those other sorts of things. You find feasts is chapter 23, okay. What do you find in the later chapters? You can pick anyone you like. Go ahead. Lots of details. You're absolutely right. And a cursory look at our own legal system would give you the same observation, right? Pretty detail-oriented, you know, specific days and times, things like that.
I really like chapter
very, and I'm glad that you said both ways, because people have been trying to categorize God since the first century as there's a God of the Old Testament, there's a God of the New Testament. The God of the Old Testament is fire, brimstone, vengeful, wrath, death to the enemy, that kind of God. Okay? And the God of the New Testament is not that way at all. He's, you know, loving, gentle, kind, gracious, merciful, so on and so forth. This chapter turns that on its head. Because you see both. Both are expressed. As strong as the language of blessing and plenty is, it's just as bad or maybe even worse in the what happens if you deny me section. Yeah. And those sorts of pairings happen a lot. Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. Later on in the law, we're going to see they have curses and blessings on either side. Doesn't the Galatian letter talk about, you know, the works of the flesh and then the fruit of the Spirit? Same sort of language goes to both. Okay. But definitely that chapter is a big, it shows both sides. Yes, sir. Very free of that. And you have a difference also in the type of kingdom, right? If you're dealing with a physical, earthly kingdom, this is the sort of law you have. When you move to a spiritual kingdom that's not bounded by government or, you know, borders or anything like that, so the laws will be different. But it also, it helps us understand when we go over to Galatians, where we have people trying to go back to the law, essentially, why Paul's so adamantly against that. He knows this law. This was his law he grew up with. He knew it better than we do, probably. And so when he's getting on to the Galatian brethren about trying to go back to the law, it's like, don't you understand what you're trying to do? You've been called to freedom, brothers, he would say. When you read the law, specifically Leviticus, you're like, wow, you know, this was tough. This was really, really strict. I want to direct your attention to a couple sections. So, there are, as we noted earlier, chapter 24 dealing with feasts, and then the later section of 24, we have some more things that are, I'm sorry, 23, not 24. 24, we have some specific instructions for the people providing oil and bread and so forth. We have the incident where someone curses the name of God in chapter 24, and it's met with very strict consequences. I guess I could go over here. Chapter 25, you deal with the Sabbath year. Every 7 years, something special was supposed to happen. And every seventh time that occurred, every seventh Sabbath year, 49th year, was the even more special Sabbath year. The Sabbath of Sabbaths, the Jubilee, it's called. And the rules that go into that. Fascinating chapter. If you are into economics, if you are into government, if you are into law, if you are into anything in any of those categories, chapter 25 is absolutely fascinating. Because it's so foreign to the way we do things today. And I'm not saying we advocate the law, but maybe there are some lessons there for us. Going forward into 25, the later section of 25, you're dealing with how do you deal with poor brethren? How do you deal with poor Israelites? And in a couple of words, as I put this in the outline, you deal with them with kindness, gentleness, you provide for them, and then you redeem them. If they get into a spot where they need to be redeemed, you go redeem them. You don't allow them to just flounder in whatever situation they're in. You go help them. Go redeem your brother is a huge theme in that section. In chapter 26, we have the blessings for obedience and disobedience, like we mentioned. We have the promise that God will keep his covenant, and then in chapter 27, the laws concerning specific vows. And just that is a very brief overview of the certain of the things that you find in that section. But I want to back up to, instead of summary, kind of go to observation. And we've done a little bit of this already, but what are the types of things that you saw and that you noticed? We've said many of them already. We've noticed a great deal of detail. God was very specific, and in varying situations, exactly what had to be done. Chapter 27 is very detail-oriented, and all the rest of the chapters are as well. God very specifically wants something to be done. What were some other things you noticed, big themes that were talked about? Yes, sir. Yes. So this process of, if you will listen to me and I will bless you, which is the first 13 verses of chapter 26. And then if you don't listen to me, I mean, you can listen to how this sounds. This is chapter 26 and verse 14. If you will not listen to me and will not do all these commandments, if you spurn my statutes, and if your soul abhors my rules so that you will not do all my commandments, but break my covenant, I will do this to you. And then many terrible things begin to be written. We've noted before, when the Bible repeats something, it's for a reason. It's for a purpose. God could have just said, if you're not faithful to the covenant, then blank. Right? But he didn't. He goes into all these different ways of saying, all these different approaches, all these different angles, to try to get it across to them. This is why these things are happening to you. And so if we fast forward to the book of Judges, where terrible things are happening to them because they forsook the covenant, oftentimes Israel's wondering, why? Why is this happening to me? God already explained why it's happening to you. Because of this. Certainly.
That's we say this is about relationship between me and you. Right? If you reject that relationship against other ideas of what you would do,
right,
these are the consequences. And when you embrace that relationship with me, these are the things that come from it. It's not it's also kind of it's a national level. I'm not saying that it's individualized, but I run a red light.
And when someone's rejecting the relationship with God, then they don't intend to go be sinful. They don't intend to break covenant. Which, to connect that back to chapter 4, all those sacrifices they kept mentioning over and over, if it was unintentional, if they didn't mean it, if it was, you know, a mistake, basically, then you would have these ways to re-enter that holy state with God. Numbers would teach us that if you reject that relationship, you know, you're cut off. That's it. It's a good lesson for us today also. Can I direct your attention to something I found really, really fascinating? This is many things. Chapter 26, we talked about this just now. The first 13 verses, if you do good, good things will happen. And I mean, really incredible good things. Verse 7, you'll chase your enemies. Verse 8, 5 of you will chase 100, and 100 will chase 10,000. That's what happens when God's on your side. You do incredible, impossible things. I am the Lord your God, verse 13. Verse 14, if you don't listen to me, then many terrible things are going to happen to you. Did you notice that's not the end of the chapter? The chapter doesn't stop with, if you listen to me, I'll bless you. If you disobey me, I'll curse you. There's more to the story, isn't there? Continue on to verse 40. We have a little bit of a sidetrack, the land it's going to enjoy its Sabbaths. I find that section fascinating, the fact that God would say, well, if you're not going to honor the Sabbath in my land, then I'm going to kick you out of the land, and the land's going to have its Sabbath. Sabbath will happen whether Israel's a part of it or not, which is sort of like, wow, okay, God's really serious about this. If God dwells with them, if that's God's land, then you have a responsibility to live a certain way while you're there. And if you refuse, God's not going to stop the whole program. He's just going to take you out of it and go on with His Sabbath. I mean, if there's a connection forward to the New Testament, will God's kingdom fail if I decide to be unfaithful? No. Will God remove me if I decide to reject that relationship? Yes. But the kingdom's going to go on. So we have connections forward to this. But I want to go to verse 40. Okay, I can continue on that for another hour or so. Where did I lose my place? There we go. Verse 40. God provides a way back in. And this, if the first section of the chapter where it speaks of God blessing His people, if that doesn't turn the idea that God is wrathful, vengeful, angry on its head, this section does. Verse 40. This is Leviticus 26. If they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers in their treachery that they committed against me and also in walking contrary to me, again, that kind of that repeated many ways of saying the same thing language. So that I walked contrary to them. There's a section in this, there's a part in this section. Did you notice the eye for an eye verse in this section as you read through? It's there. You have to find it. But you have this. You walk contrary to me, I walk contrary to you. Continue on. And brought them into the land of their enemies. If then their uncircumcised heart is humbled, and they make amends for their iniquity, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and I will remember my covenant with Isaac, and my covenant with Abraham, and I will remember the land. You remember in Romans chapter 2, Paul talks about those who were Jews inwardly? Those who were circumcised not in the heart? It's not his idea. God says, what happens if you come back? I will remember my covenant with the ones I promised it to, with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and I will remember the land. But the land shall be abandoned by them, and enjoy its Sabbaths while it lies desolate without them, and they shall make amends for their iniquity because they spurned my rules and their soul abhorred my statutes. Yet for all that, when they're in the land of their enemies, I will not spurn them, neither will I abhor them, so as to destroy them utterly and break my covenant with them, for I am the Lord their God. But I will for their sake remember the covenant with their forefathers, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am the Lord. Like Levi said, this is literally the rest of the Bible. This is the rest of the Old Testament story. Where Israel, might say through Judges, kind of spirals back and forth between kind of good and really bad. And then things get really terrible, and finally God raises up a king, David, and they have good success, and Solomon compounds that success. And then the kingdom splits, and they're right back in it. That downward spiral. Until eventually they're kicked out of both Israel and Judah. And they go live in Assyria and Babylon. A few of them came back, reestablished the temple, reestablished the wall in Jerusalem, but they were never the same. God kept all of this that He said. He was faithful to it. Kind of telling the story of Israel going forward. What else did you see as you read through the book? If nobody gets to it before I do, I'm coming back to chapter 25. But what else did you see? What did you find? What did you write down that you noticed as you read through the text? Yes. Yes. Yes, so the connection to rest, the connection to Sabbath. This is actually one of our discussion questions. I had it up here. What are the holy convocations of Leviticus 23? They're their feasts, right? The Feast of Booths, Feast of Tabernacles, and Passover, and Unleavened Bread, and so on. And what do they all have in common? It's what Jerry just mentioned. They all talk about stopping work. Did you notice that? They all talk about stopping what you're doing. And it's this repeated drumbeat that runs throughout the feast. You have it first in Leviticus 23 in verse 3, you shall do no work. Now we knew that because it's the Sabbath day, and the Sabbath day is Exodus 20, it's one of the Ten Commandments. But here in this section it's reiterated what you're supposed to do. And what you're supposed to do is not work. Not even in your dwelling places. If you go down to verse 8, during the Feast of Passover and Unleavened Bread, holy convocation, you don't do any ordinary work. That is the theme that runs throughout Leviticus 23. So, what would that tell you if you're an Israelite? What's the point of being told repeatedly, don't work on my days? I mean it. It's holy. What you're doing on those days is more important than work. Now, how counter does that run to the American culture? Where the first question we ask most everybody is, what do you do? We're working. Working all the time. Working for the weekend, right? Working so we can get off on the weekend and do what we want to do for a while. God over and over and says, work's not the point of being an Israelite. God is the point of being an Israelite. And you're going to be refocused on God on a weekly basis, on a few times a year basis during the feasts, on a every 7 year basis with the Sabbath year, and then every 49th year with the year of Jubilee. God continually draws his people's attention back to himself, back to God. I think that's an important point. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think in I agree with the point that allows us to focus on that, but
mm-hmm.
I think, even beyond that, it shows that God's attention is our rest.
Yes.
Relieving us of burden.
Yes.
And because even the land has given us that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the point. Jesus is offering Sabbath for the world. Freedom and rest. I mean, if Israel was meant to work continually all the time, without rest, without break, why didn't they just stay in Egypt? That's what they did there. They were slaves, forced to work, where God says, no, I'm going to give you rest. And when God gives you rest, would Israel suffer economically because God's giving them rest? What about every 7 years where they weren't allowed to plow their fields or grow anything? Would they suffer? No! God says, I'm going to give you enough food to cover you for 2 years after that. Both the year you have to rest and the year you have to spend restarting your crops, right? You can't just go out after 1 year and go, okay, let me go pick it off the vine. It's not there, right? You got to go grow it again. So God says, I'm going to give you enough food both for your Sabbath year and for the eighth year so that you can eat in the ninth. They're not going to suffer because of this. God's going to provide. God's going to give them what they need to be rest, to have rest. And you mentioned this, just having that one day off, basically a week where they weren't allowed to do ordinary work. When the Greeks became acquainted with Jewish culture, you know, that's the thing they complained about. When the Greeks first encountered the Jewish culture, that was one of their things they said was, these people are lazy. They don't work every day. They get one day off a week. That was what God wanted for them, to have rest, to be devoted that way. I want to show you something. This is chapter 25. When you talk about social justice, loaded term, right? Very loaded term. God's version is very different. God's version of this is revolutionary. Reading chapter 25 as an American sounds about as foreign as anything in the law. Because there's no system to accumulate wealth over time. This is an agricultural society. Wealth is measured by land ownership and your ability to farm that land. That's how you get rich. That's how the rich man has many crops and then he builds barns to store his crops. Why? Not so he can sit on them, so that he can grow even more than the next time and get even more. You see the idea? You couldn't do that in Israel, or at least you weren't supposed to be able to. Because every 7 years, everybody had to stop growing everything and depend on God. And let's say you have wealth. Let's say you acquire land. You buy it from your neighbors within your tribe and you acquire a lot of land. Every 49 years, that's out. It all goes back to who it belonged to originally. And everybody went back home to their ancestral lands. There's no, you know, land barons in ancient Israel. So to our ears, it sounds weird. Well, how are you supposed to accumulate wealth? How are you supposed to give it to you? That's not the point. They're not there to be, you know, to lord it over one another. They're not there to be the rich and the poor. It's not what God had intended for them. Reading this section, beginning in chapter 25, for one, verse 2, chapter 25, verse 2, when you come to the land that I give you. Why is it they had to be this way? It wasn't their land. You know, there was no, this is your land and this is my land. There was no song like that in Israel. It was God's land. And He dictated how they used it. By the way, is it still God's land today? Yes. The United States just happened to have this piece of dirt right now, but it's God's earth. And it's His land, ultimately speaking. Go down to chapter 25 and verse 17. You shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. Therefore, you shall do my statutes and keep my rules and perform them. And then you will dwell in the land securely. Being on God's earth and profiting from it and having the good life in the Lord means you do it His way. There is no my way and I'll be all right. No, there is God's way if you want to be okay. Look at verse 23. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. This is the Levitical version of, this world is not my home, I'm just passing through. This is their version. The land belongs to God. You don't sell it forever to one another. It doesn't belong to you like that. It's so foreign to how we look at these sorts of things. Look down at verse 35. Same chapter. If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall tell him to work harder, and do his best, and it'll be okay. It's not what it says. If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you. Take no interest from him or profit, but fear your God, so that your brother may live beside you. What was the interest rate in ancient Israel? None. You mean if I let an Israelite borrow 100 shekels, I can't charge him interest? Yeah, that's what that means. If your brother has to borrow 100 shekels, does he have 101 to give you back? No, not really. But that's how the wealthy accumulate more, right? Now, they were allowed to do that with non-Israelites. They were allowed to do that with the nations. But with Israelites, you didn't treat them that way. They needed something, you borrowed it to them, you lent it to them, they paid it back whatever it was. Why were they not taking any interest? Verse 36, but fear your God, that your brother may live beside you. You shall not lend him your money at interest, nor give him your food for profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. Over and over, God keeps returning their attention to why they're there. That line should sound familiar. It's the first line in the Ten Commandments. I brought you here. I am your God. Here's how you're going to treat one another. If your brother becomes poor, verse 39, and sells himself to you, you shall not make him serve as a slave. He shall be with you as a hired worker, as a sojourner. He shall serve till the year of Jubilee. Then, verse 41, he shall go out from you, he and his children with him, and go back to his own clan and return to the possession of his fathers. For they are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. Over and over and over again, God keeps calling them back to who they are and why they're treating one another a certain type of way. Very, 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 very different than the nations around them at the time, and any nation ever since that acted this way.
Well, I would add that this is reinforced over and over again in the prophet.
Oh, yes.
That
yes.
Their violation of these principles is called out directly in very strong language by the prophet, their abuse of
yes. Absolutely. He mentioned, you know, the prophets condemned this specific thing over and over and over again. And I heard somebody word it this way a long time ago, and they say, okay, if you approach everything in the law, what do you think would be the easiest commands to violate first? What would be the first commands to go out the window if you start to deviate from God's law? Which ones would you violate first? Would you go against the, you know, the first command? Would you go build an idol? Probably not. If you started to deviate from the law, would you go murder? Probably not. What would you give up first? Well, picking up sticks on the Sabbath. Why was he out picking up sticks? He thought he needed some sticks. The easiest commands to give up would be the ones where you have to sacrifice. The ones where you have to go care for your poor brother. Where you have to go redeem your relative who got himself into that fix, and now you have to go redeem them. The feasts, where it's really just a burden to go to Jerusalem, right? And it worked its way in. Israel didn't keep these things. Yes. This was not how they were supposed to be. And then it makes the condemnations you read in the prophets, they make a lot more sense when you're familiar with the law itself. One more. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Certainly. Go meet the need when it's there. Go address it. Right? Don't do, you know, be warmed and filled and do neither one of them. You haven't done anything. Well, if you think about lessons Israel is supposed to learn from the law, you know, it's not just follow the commandments. They're supposed to learn something in the process. And one of the things they're supposed to learn is your brother and your sister is more important than what you got in the barn or you acquiring this. You need to be able to take care of one another first. If God repeatedly says, I want you to stop working, but I'll provide for you in the meantime, then the whole working process must be second to something. It's got to be second to service, you know, to God. Sure. Okay, well, we're at 7:40, just don't ignore that last part. We did answer a few of the questions. We did get through number one. When the Lord's name is blasphemed, he takes that extremely seriously. Our study of Exodus should have helped us know why. Because God's name is very special and he's defensive of it. And I gave you some verses for that. Now next week is where we really, really, really get to focus forward. Okay. We get to look and we get to take the things that we've learned and a few of the things that we've discussed and bring them forward into 2020. We're not trying to reestablish, you know, the Levitical economic system. But there are lessons from the law that we learn and that we apply today. And we've talked about a few of those today and last week. And we'll get a chance to focus on those specifically starting on Wednesday. And we'll go back over the last two sections. We'll go back over those first seven and those last few and answer some specific questions. What do we notice in those sections that looks like Jesus reminds us of him and his work and who he was, our worship, and then other parts of the New Testament. as we'll see those things. This will bring tonight's study to a close. At the end of our studies, we offer everyone an opportunity, if there's a need, spiritually speaking, to make things right with the Lord, to beg His forgiveness for sins, or to ask for the prayers of one another. It's a good opportunity to ask for that. And we'll do that at this time. The song we're going to sing in just a second should be Rock of Ages. So if you have a need at this time, we encourage you to come up while we stand and while we sing.